Welcome back to Human Emotion. This is our final lecture on answering the question, is the brain emotional? Or can we find certain parts of our brain and how they operate to give rise to emotions? Here in our third and last module on the emotional brain, we'll focus on emotion control or regulation, as well as emotional specificity in the brain. Again, I want us to think about this fact that up until recently, the brain was really thought of as being associated with a whole wide host of functions: smell, hearing, speech, touch, taste, vision, face recognition. And emotion was relatively devoid of this entire portrait. And so it's really an exciting time right now, where we now can think of the brain as not only solely devoted to different kinds of motor and cognitive functions, but actually something that is a fundamental part of what makes us emotional creatures in the first place. So now that we know the brain, yes, indeed, can be emotional, how can we start to scientifically study it more precisely to really identify the particular regions or systems that interact to give rise to help explain what makes us happy? What makes us feel depressed? Why do we get so angry sometimes? Why can't we control our fear? These are the kinds of questions that neuroscience has the potential to help address. And I hope that you've seen this exciting potential of studying affective neuroscience. And so with that, today, we're going to conclude our discussion of the brain as part of the central nervous system we talked about earlier, and wrap up with the third of three major emotional systems. So we started with the striatal system, or striatum, the limbic system, and today we're going to be talking about the neocortex. So I want to start now by talking about this neocortex and by focusing on the prefrontal cortex. So this is really, again, the outer layer of the brain. And the prefrontal cortex, it's in the front of the brain. And it's been highly involved in all kinds of complex cognitive processes. And with respect to emotion, it's involved in the kind of cognitive control or regulation of emotion. It's thought of as the way we harness or rein in our intense emotions, how we keep, you know, control over them, sort of keep our anger, you know, from sort of bubbling over, keep our tears at bay. The neocortex is a part of the brain that's associated with that. So when we think about the neocortex then, we're going to be talking about the prefrontal cortex. So the prefrontal cortex, often referred to as the PFC, plays a critical role, again, in the regulation of emotion. It functions to help us anticipate the consequences of our actions in the future, as well as help us delay immediate gratification of our wants and our desires. It helps us maintain emotions over time. It helps us organize emotional behavior towards achieving very specific goals. So it's really sort of like, in many ways, the superego of our brain, sort of keeping us in check, keeping us in line with the norms that we need to sort of function as a productive member of society. So when we think about emotion regulation then, we need to sort of first talk about what emotion regulation is. So James Gross is a professor at Stanford University and a pioneer in the field of emotion regulation. And he's defined emotion regulation as the processes by which individuals influence which emotions they have, when they have them, and how they experience and express their emotions. So this is one of the most commonly used definitions of emotion regulation in the field and is the working definition that we'll be following today in our lecture, thinking about emotion control and regulation in the brain. James Gross identified what he called a process model of emotion regulation. And here you can see that emotion regulation, if we think of it as a time course unfolding, can be broken up into sort of four different kinds of pieces. You can encounter a situation in the environment where you can select whether you want to modify the situation ahead of time. Then there's a sort of assessment of the event once it's happened, where you devote attention to it, or you can reappraise or think about it differently. Followed by, once the emotion is elicited, you have a response, and you can engage in strategies that are called response focus, such as suppressing your emotions. We'll get into this process model in more depth later in the course when we really delve into emotion regulation, but I'm showing it to you here because, in particular today, We're going to be talking about specific kinds of emotion regulation, focusing here on this third circle to the right, cognitive reappraisal, which is really born out of this process model of emotion regulation. So again, this is the idea of engaging in what we call sort of antecedent focus strategies, or ways to regulate our emotions before they sort of hit their maximum intensity. So just remember this strategy here as a way one can regulate their emotion, and a major way that researchers trying to study emotion regulation in the brain have used as sort of an initial entry point. So most of the initial studies on emotion regulation using neuroimaging have been pioneered by Kevin Oxner, a professor of psychology at Columbia University. And here he had a paradigm, really novel paradigm, for trying to study the ways in which we regulate our emotions versus just naturally letting them unfold, and did this in the context of a neuroimaging study. So here in the study, participants would view an emotional stimulus. You may remember us talking about the different IAPS photos, right? These kind of standardized photos that can be incredibly negative as well as positive or neutral. So in this particular study, participants came into the scanner and they were given different kinds of strategies to regulate their emotions. Right, so they would be told they could either increase their emotions, right, just simply look at the picture and respond naturally, or decrease them. They'd be given this strategy cue, followed by either a negative or neutral photo. Afterwards, they would self-report how strongly they felt, a sort of affective response, and then told to relax before the next trial. And really importantly, what I have here is what this meant when it said to sort of increase or decrease different kinds of negative emotions. So essentially what these are here on the far right are different kinds of cognitive reappraisal strategies. So you could increase your negative emotions by looking at the image and thinking about the image in a way that actually makes you feel more negative. You could also decrease your negative emotion by thinking about the image in a way that made you feel less negative. Or you could simply look at the negative image and just observe it naturally, right? Looking at either negative or a neutral image. So it's really important to keep in mind here is that individuals were either told to view these photos naturally or to cognitively reappraise them by either trying to cognitively reframe it in a way that made them feel more negative, or cognitively reframe it in a way that made them feel less negative. One of the common images that was used in this study is a man sitting in a hospital bed trying to pull himself up out of bed. And so, for example, to increase negative, you may reappraise that photo thinking that the man is very sick, he's not going to get better anytime soon, and things are very grave for him. You could also try to decrease your negative emotion by looking at that very same picture, but construing it in a way that, well, he may be sick, but he's going to get well soon, and he'll be right as rain in no time. So what happens when you actually bring people into a scanner, have them view negative photos such as a man sitting in a hospital bed, and have them engage in strategies that may either sort of increase or decrease their emotions by simply thinking or reappraising the photo in different ways? So here's what he found in his studies. If we look at some of the neuroimaging patterns, he found, and what he did is compared a condition when someone tried to reappraise by increasing their negative emotions versus just simply looking at the negative photo. He also compared reappraising by trying to decrease your negative emotions versus just simply looking at the photo. And essentially what he found is there are specific systems that seem to be involved in helping us either upregulate or downregulate, or either increase or decrease our negative emotions. And these systems he referred to as the lateral and sometimes medial prefrontal cortex, as well as the anterior cingulate. So what these studies really did for the first time was pick out regions of the brain, particularly as we're talking about, say, the prefrontal cortex especially, that seem to really help us cognitively manage our emotions, to take a scene from our everyday life and just think about it differently in a way that actually can help us change the way we feel emotions. So these are really pioneering studies in this field for the first time. There's been other kinds of studies since then that are taking a different approach by doing what they call functional connectivity. So here, instead of looking and picking out particular regions of the brain like the prefrontal cortex and seeing how they are related to trying to regulate your emotions versus just experiencing them naturally, here what researchers do is almost look at interrelationships between different brain regions. So you can see here it looks at the relationship between the prefrontal cortex top down to the amygdala. And we talked about the amygdala as kind of the emotional intensity sort of computer or region of the brain. So individuals that seem to have really good control or regulation of their emotion exhibit what's called a top-down control of the prefrontal cortex to the amygdala. And again, not to get too Freudian here, but often people will use the metaphor of the superego or the PFC kind of coming down and inhibiting the impulses and desires of the amygdala, or kind of the id, so to speak. You can also go the other way too, where the amygdala can kind of go bottom up and maybe even override some of the impulses of the PFC, or in some ways it can give feedback to the PFC and sort of tell them where how intense that emotional response is, and the PFC can come back down. The important thing here is that this is a bidirectional relationship, that these brain regions like the PFC for control of emotion and amygdala for emotion intensity, they don't operate by themselves. They're not sort of neighbors hanging out, but they actually have kind of the inner relationship with one another, like the superego and the id, that they're constantly sort of in this battle to sort of express emotions from the amygdala and sort of inhibit or control them from the prefrontal cortex. So this is a way we can also look at how does the brain engage in this ongoing battle to try to manage our intense emotions. And there's also lesion studies that can provide fantastic insights into emotion regulation by looking at particular areas of the brain that have been damaged and that are then associated with troubles regulating emotions. So we talked about this a little when we talked about the case of Phineas Gage, who had selective damage to his orbital frontal cortex and exhibited very bizarre or strange behavior afterwards. More recent research pioneered by Jenny Beer, who's now at the University of Texas at Austin, did a fascinating series of studies with human patients who had orbital frontal cortex damage and found that these individuals experienced profound trouble regulating emotions. So she brought these people into the lab and found that they did a whole host of very unusual things. They would greet strangers by kissing them. They would engage in really inappropriate, almost sort of vulgar jokes with the experimenter. And they would disclose incredibly personal pieces of information to relative strangers. She took this one step further and had them engage in what she called a teasing study. So she would ask the patient with orbital frontal cortex damage to generate a nickname for a stranger and tease them with this nickname. And what she found in this paradigm is that they tended to tease in an overly forward and even sexual manner and showed very little embarrassment when doing this. So this suggests in many ways that lesion studies, especially to the OFC, also highlight particular parts of the brain that may be really and especially involved in emotion regulation. People have also found as well with orbital frontal cortex patients that they really show almost these blunted responses to really evocative images. So this is a neutral image, and this is an example of a very negative kind of gory image or disturbing image, and you see a relative healthy control when they see these kinds of images. They'll show a spike in their skin conductance level, kind of showing a relative arousal in their sympathetic nervous system, whereas your orbital frontal cortex patients are relatively blunted. So they just don't seem to be able to sort of harness their emotions appropriately as well to show responsivity when seeing disturbing images. So I want to turn now to emotion specificity. And here, what we're going to be thinking about is to what extent can we isolate different key brain regions with certain aspects of emotion. So we've talked about this a little bit thus far in the course. So this is including, we first talked about the amygdala, right, as associated with emotion intensity. In particular, detecting and learning what parts of our brain have emotional salience, especially for fear. We then talked about the insula. And here, we saw that the insular cortex is thought to play a critical role in the bodily experience of emotion, like disgust, for example, and is connected to other brain structures that help regulate the body's kind of autonomic functions. So not surprisingly, this region's been associated with processing taste information and plays an important role in the experience of disgust. Third, we've talked about the anterior cingulate, right, or the ACC, located in the middle of the brain, just behind the prefrontal cortex, and thought to play a central role in attention. And it may be particularly important with regards to conscious, subjective emotional experiences like happiness or sadness, and may play a role in initiating motivated behavior relevant to one's emotion states. Then we talked about the ventral striatum, right? So this is a kind of group of subcortical structures that play a really critical role in the experience of pleasure and the experience of reward. And more recently, we just talked about the prefrontal cortex as sort of our, you know, super ego or cognitive control that helps us rein in or harness our emotional states. And this all started early in the course by talking about hemispheric asymmetry, where we saw the left, you know, side of the brain, relative activity associated with greater positive emotions compared to the right that was associated with greater negative emotions. But is the brain really organized in this way for emotion? Can we really, you know, map specific emotions onto particular parts of the brain? Or are we really just doing, you know, modern day phrenology? Is the brain really organized in this way? So there's two views on this issue. The first is what's called the locationist view. And the locationist perspective suggests that distinct emotion categories like happiness, sadness, fear, anger, and disgust are biologically based, and they can be localized to specific brain regions. So for every basic emotion, we see a specific physiological response or a specific, perhaps, part of the brain that's associated with that emotion. This is contrasted with the psychological constructionist perspective, who suggests, by contrast, much like when you're baking or putting a meal together, that emotions are constructed of different ingredients or mental states that occur when many different systems in the brain work together. And these networks of brain regions interact to produce things like valence, positive, negative, or arousal level. And emotions emerge when these neural systems associated with valence or arousal kind of interact together to produce this distributed pattern across the brain. So there is no one specific brain region for a given emotion. And instead, each emotion is really heterogeneous. There's different kinds of fear, for example. There's no one kind. And each have different neural patterns. So ways that researchers have tried to really pin these two perspectives together and really see whether it's the locationist or the psychological constructionist that wins out is by doing these meta-analyses. So these are just spanning across a large range of studies to see what are the results that emerge when you put all these studies together. The first sort of meta-analysis of affective neuroscience, one of them was done by Fan et al. In 2002. Here he aggregated across 55 fMRI and PET studies on emotion between 1990 and 2000. And what he did was tabulate the number of studies that report brain activation in specific regions for tasks eliciting these emotions. Use different kinds of analyses, such as chi-squared analysis, to examine essentially the proportion of studies that report activation in a specific region for a given emotion. And here he identified two regions, the amygdala that seemed to be associated highly with fear, but also somewhat with happiness and sadness, as well as what he called subcolossal regions that include the cingulate, you know, and you can see here, most highly associated in 46% of studies with sadness, but also somewhat for happiness and anger. Okay, so that was a first pass. But since then, there's been additional meta-analyses that include one by Kober et al. In 2008, who reviewed 162 neuroimaging studies between 1990 and 2005 to determine if groups of brain regions show consistent patterns of activation during both emotion experience and emotion perception. They used incredibly complex approaches called a multi-level kernel density analysis and found six networks associated with basic psychological operations. And at the very, very bottom of this, you can see what's called group level, six networks. And these are on the left here. So the first was what they called the core limbic group. So this was a sort of a center that they called an integrative emotional center that played a general role in evaluating the emotional significance of events. Then there was the lateral paralimbic system that plays a role in motivation, contributing to evaluating stimuli and, in particular, reward. This is followed by the medial prefrontal cortex, which plays a role in both the generation and regulation of emotion. Fourth is the cognitive motor network, which is thought to play a more general role in information processing and cognitive control. And finally, the fifth, occipital visual association, and sixth, the medial posterior regions seem to play a joint role in visual processing and attention to emotional stimuli. So this was a really important study that was done that really sort of pointed out six kind of key regions or networks that help explain different aspects of emotion-related processing. And then the last meta-analysis I'll touch on is the most recent one by Lindquist et al. In 2012, where they then built onto 91 fMRI studies on motion perception or experience between 1990 and 2007, used a similar analysis to the Kober et al. Study. They at the end, though, they used a density analysis to identify regions with consistent activations for specific emotions, and used a chi-squared analysis to try to create these maps of the brain to indicate if certain active regions were more active in studies of each emotion category versus more of the average across all other emotions. And what they did is they found functionally consistent and selective regions. In other words, they found support for both the constructionist approach in that no region demonstrated functional specificity for the basic emotions. So this seemed to provide kind of the strongest support for the constructionist approach in many ways, though they did find some selective regions as well in line with the other perspective. So when we think about some of the takeaway questions then for today, when we've talked about, you know, emotion control and emotion specificity, what are some of the take-home messages we might want to take with us? So the first is, what neural regions and patterns of connectivity have been associated with emotion regulation? And what experimental paradigms were used to gather this evidence? Second, what are the two perspectives to emotion specificity in the brain, the ones we kind of pitted against each other and then walked through a series of meta-analyses to try to determine what kind of support we have for each? And then finally, what evidence do meta-analyses of emotion tell us about emotion and the brain? So now I want to segue to our Experts in Emotion interview series. For our Experts in Emotion interview today, we have the honor of speaking with Dr. Tor Wager. Dr. Wager is the director of the Cognitive and Affective Neuroscience Laboratory at the University of Colorado Boulder and received his PhD from the University of Michigan in cognitive psychology with a focus in cognitive neuroscience in 2003. He joined the faculty of Columbia University as an assistant professor in 2004 and was appointed associate professor in 2009. And recently in 2010, he joined the faculty of the Department of Psychology and Neuroscience at the University of Colorado Boulder. Dr. Wager's research focuses on how expectations shape responses to pain and emotion in the brain and body. His work integrates new and novel analytic and meta-analytic methods, fMRI, and psychophysiology. He's published over 60 articles and received numerous awards, including the Innovation Award from the Social and Affective Neuroscience Society, as well as the Janet Taylor Spence Award from the Association for Psychological Science. His work has been highly featured in media outlets including the New York Times, LA Times, National Geographic, The Huffington Post, Science Daily, CNN, and more. So I now turn with great pleasure to our Experts in Emotion interview with Dr. Tor Wager on the question of where exactly is emotion in the brain.